continued on side two.
You know, and help to analyze the differences in pediatric behavior and the differences in bilirubin therapy, exchange transfusion, the difference in the use of bilirubin, the various clinical approaches, and was able to persuade the director of nurseries at McGee to institute, you know, a number of the changes such that the disease disappeared. We then remain interested in trying to figure out why it had disappeared. When you change many things at one time, you're often not sure what it was. And had been developing a biochemical theory for the nature of the disease, which I think is pertinent. The pediatricians had known that the babies at risk for Kern icterus had high bilirubins, low albumins, and low pH. But no single one of those was enough to predict with confidence that a baby would develop the disorder sufficient to take the risk of the established treatment, which was an exchange blood transfusion. Because the transfusion itself in very small premature babies carries a risk, and the uncertainty was great enough that it was never done. I took off one internal sabbatical once and spent my time at Carnegie Mellon University. That was the third sabbatical. I mentioned the other two. And took courses in membrane biochemistry and biophysics, and suddenly realized that I knew the answer, because we know the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation for the dissociation of an acid. I knew the dissociation constant of the acid bilirubin, and I knew the binding affinity constant for the binding of bilirubin to albumin. And I suddenly realized that all I had to do was to solve the two equations simultaneously, and I could give in one formula an expression for the concentration of acid bilirubin, which included albumin, bilirubin, and pH, and was then able retrospectively to go through the data at McGee of several years in which babies had died and had been proven to have Kern icterus in autopsy, pardon me, in whom the diagnosis had not been made while they were alive, and was able to predict on the basis of the limited data over 90% of them, so that even though by that time the disease was gone, we had a theoretical basis of understanding what had happened.
Dr. Kleansky, I would say, I mean, that you enjoy your work so much, that you regard what you've done with a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction, right?
Yes, indeed. For a while, I thought that the only thing I enjoyed, you know, was pathology. But then there came a point where I realized that if I'd been a garbage collector, I would have loved it. Because there's got to be a better way, you know, a more efficient way, a way of doing it, you know, with better salvage of the material. So that if you put your interest and your brains, you know, into what you're doing, you can find a way. You know, anything can be fun. And I have fun with almost anything I do.
You're an academic.
I think so. I hope so.
I would also like to ask you, what made you become a doctor in the first place?
And why I became a pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
Became a doctor quite unreasoningly. My youngest uncle was probably 16, 17 years old when I was born, and immediately became my, you know, mentor, guide, playmate. And by the time I was, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years old, he was going to college and he was a pre-medical student. He played the piano, I wanted to play the piano. He's going to college, I want to go to college. He's going to medical school. I grew up knowing that I wanted to go to medical school, not knowing what or why or what it was. And as the years go by, the practical test of your abilities and your interests mean that it's not an impossibility, and I just never lost that interest. why I chose to be a pathologist is another story. Even as an intern, I was attracted to many things. I thought I'd be a psychiatrist, I thought I'd be an internist, I thought I'd be... And I realized that many of the practicing physicians I saw gave their time not to the people who needed their services, but to those who could afford to pay for them. And in pathology, I saw us being immune from those pressures. The pathologist spends their time according to the intellectual interest of the material. And if Mrs. Slumbum, you know, has got a fascinating problem and never paid anybody a nickel, you spend all day or all week or all month and you figure out the problem. And if the wife, you know, of the wealthiest member of the board has a routine problem, you're done. I mean, you do what has to be done, but it doesn't catch your interest. It doesn't need any more than that. So you don't have to cater to people because of who they are or their position or their wealth. You spend your time according to the intellectual interest of the material. And that's a tremendous and fascinating aspect about pathology. You also are free to do what is important medically. A former dean of our medical school once said that 70% of the time of a practicing pediatrician, in his case, is spent doing things that somebody could do for the patient better, but that the doctor must do because the patient expects it of the doctor, and because they're paying the doctor for it, and that someone else might as well take the preliminary history or do preliminary physical. Somebody else might do a better job of being sure, do you really understand what we've asked you to do? Do you understand your drugs? Do you have any more questions? But they think the doctor is busy and everything gets rushed. Then you hear patients complaining later on that they really didn't have the time. In pathology, we've got technologists who do what they are capable of doing under the supervision of the physician. So the physician's role is that of teacher, of supervisor, of quality control. The things that someone else can do, and this Rabbi Karp taught me also, never do something yourself that somebody less well qualified can do, if not as well as you, can do adequately. Because if you persist in doing it yourself, you'll be denying someone else an opportunity for improving, you know, their job description, or their ability skill. For better pay. And if you persist in doing it yourself, you'll never get around to doing the things that only you can do. So the pathologist has the freedom and the opportunity of doing those things.
Doing everything but getting rich.
Obviously not important.
In the era that began roughly near the end of my residency, the salary of pathologists improved tremendously in the late 50s. And the financial position of pathologists is much better than it was in the era when your husband was in pathology. We don't do as well as surgeons or radiologists or anesthesiologists, but pathology is in a good, comfortable, you know, middle zone.
You can live with it.
Yeah. And even at the academic salaries, which I say are roughly half, very comfortable. Never felt the need for any more.
You've obviously met a few people who have influenced you. For example, Rabbi Karp, who you mentioned a number of times. In the course of your travels, work-related, have you met any wonderful people that you feel have influenced
you?
Me,
all kinds of wonderful people. One example, maybe again an influence of my going into pathology, was my professor of pathology in medical school, mm-hmm. who was a quiet, soft-spoken, logical man, you know, in a school that wasn't terribly noted for that, and who said, in pathology, we think, and who gave us, you know, the first day in the course, gave us an examination, said, a man is green. Please explain it. Said, I don't really expect you're going to be able to explain it, but you've got to be able to generate ideas and generate hypotheses. And years later, at my 25th reunion from medical school, I was surprised that 10 members of my class had become pathologists.
Interesting.
And we hadn't known it. And every one of them remembered the influence of that haven of rationality. So that was another influence. The dean of the medical school at the University of Wisconsin. During the time when I was trying to decide what to do, I approached him and said, "Dr. Middleton, I'm interested in a residency in medicine." He said, "Cleo, you'd be a fine academic internist, but there was never a great internist who wasn't a pathologist first. Take a year of pathology, and then you can do internal medicine. And you take a year of pathology, and you say, look,
you're hooked.
I'm hooked. I'm never going to leave." So, but you know, there are hundreds of them. There are people in this medical school and others.
But what was the name of your professor, as a matter of interest, of pathology?
John Gregory. John Gregory.
He had the best of two worlds.
Yeah. I mean, they're the stories of a different era. When I finished my residency, I was trying to decide whether to remain in the university or go to a community hospital. And one of my mentors at that era was Hilliard Cohen, a pathologist at the Menorah Hospital in Kansas City. And he had become my sort of informal confidant, advisor during residency. And I said, "Dr. Cohen, I'm undecided whether to remain in the academic sphere or to go to a community hospital." And he bristled to his full 5'2" and said, "Cleo, you have no choice. You must remain an academic pathologist. Your choice is between the university and the community hospital." And that taught me the very valuable lesson that every pathologist can and should be an academic. And that's one of the unique opportunities of pathology. The clinicians, the internists, the pediatricians in the university may be academic. Rarely do they have that opportunity outside of the university.
Let's continue.
You want to go on talking about people? I was going to ask you about awards. You have been the recipient of a number of awards. Would you like to tell us those that have been most meaningful to you? Well, I'm sure they all are.
Well, I've really not received a lot of awards. Anything in the way of awards has been primarily for my involvement with the American Cancer Society. A couple of years back, I was the Volunteer of the Year for the state of Pennsylvania. I won a similar award for the Greater Pittsburgh Unit of the American Cancer Society. I think they call it the Gold Sword Award, which they give only intermittently to people who have given many, many years of devoted service to the society. That's it. Most of the reward, or most of the award you get from awards, is the knowledge that you've been doing things that are useful or helpful to others, and the real reward is the internal one.
You are a prolific writer. You have done a lot of papers.
No, as academics go, I've done very poorly, and indeed I've written very little. And most of the research I've done never gets published. And that's...
You
look at it, and I've had a long, fallow period as I've really been the dilettante far too much, going from one thing to another rather than sticking in any one area. But I've been the spearhead of always developing the new area. I mean, I developed the central labs. I was the first to create the School of Medical Technology for the university. I was the medical director of the central labs. I set up the Falk Clinic Laboratory. Whenever there was a new problem or a new project or something that needed to be done, I'd be the one, so that my development was often at that level, but often not the kind of thing that ended up in publication, even when some of it should have been written.
When you do not have the responsibilities now that you have of administration, etc., do you think you'll devote your time to more writing?
No, I probably have administrative responsibilities. I don't have the practice responsibilities anymore, but as vice chairman of the department, I have a department of over 85 full-time MDs and PhDs. I'm responsible for 1/8 of the total curriculum of the School of Medicine, the sophomore pathology course. I'm responsible for our graduate program in pathology, responsible for our residency program in pathology. I'm the president of our practice plan, and therefore financially responsible for the, you know, the economics of this large group. In many ways, you know, I'm running a business for which patients are billed almost $100 million a year. I mean, each of these hospitals, as you well know, although the pathology laboratory may represent a little over 10% of the direct costs of the hospital, since the administrator intends to make a profit from the laboratory, it's probably 15 to 20% of the billings of the hospital. And it's not profit for the pathologist, but you're still controlling major resources and major numbers of people. So that, I'm running a post-sophomore fellowship program, which is something my colleagues gave me $300,000 to create a program to help recruit and attract competent people into pathology. Pathology has been having real difficulty recruiting.
It takes so many years.
Well, it's one of the longer residencies, a 5-year residency, and there's that problem of, you know, the control of your own destiny. And even though it's the intellectually most attractive, you know, people have been a little bit concerned. So I'm running a post-sophomore fellowship program, and I'm offering to our medical students here and around the country an opportunity to spend an entire year in pathology after their sophomore year of medical school. And I'm paying them $11,000 for the year and their next year's tuition.
That's a nice
limited tuition. To tuition at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine in-state, which is about $14,000. So it's a $25,000 package. And this year I have three of the top brightest students in the class, and we'll soon select, you know, four students for next year, and they're having a ball. Because I've designed a program that emphasizes the kind of flexibility that the pathologist has. They're all doing a minimum of 3 months of practice of pathology, you know, autopsy, and a minimum of 3 months of research, and they can spend the other 6 months however they like. You know, some of them are doing pure research, some of them are mixing it. The young woman who chose me as her mentor, we're writing a book on how to teach diagnostic case problem solving, the approach to clinical medicine, to junior and senior medical students.
That's wonderful.
And we just sent off a letter to the publisher this week, and you know, maybe that will come along. But the fantastically bright young woman, you know, who's, you know, writing a series of cases, you know, with a case history, then a detailed analysis of how the trained person approaches the problem of extracting the information, using the information, building it to a diagnosis, and then presenting the findings at the postmortem examination with a discussion of the major pathophysiology, you know, involved. And we're hoping that that will be a useful book, you know, for medical students.
Do you have any other information that you would like to volunteer that you think we should include? Some personal experiences in Pittsburgh.
I'm sort of talked out at the moment. If I could think, you know, I had lots of personal experiences in Pittsburgh, but I'm trying to relate them to
You don't have to relate them to medicine.
What?
You don't have to relate them to
medicine. Yeah, I'm trying to think to be relating them to the Jewish aspects.
Right.
Not really. I've had about enough. Are there any general areas or topics or areas?
I think we've covered almost everything.
We've covered all the points I made. Somehow or other have come up in this conversation.
Yes.
I guess you've answered them all.
Nothing in memorabilia.
You certainly made pathology sound awfully interesting.
Oh, it is. I mean, I'm a very good...
You give me a new perspective
I'm a very good recruiter.
Yes, I can hear that.
At the University of Kansas, I ran the residency program. And all of the first year, OBGYN residents and surgical residents were required by their faculty to do 3 months of pathology. I was so successful as a recruiter that they quit because a third of the people were changing their mind about what they'd already decided they wanted to be. They were shifting into pathology. They then began sending me second and third year residents who had enough time invested that they didn't switch. But pathology is really a discipline that is the most intellectually attractive discipline in medicine. Our problem in recruiting is that we're now the only discipline in the practice of medicine where students do not have an obligatory clinical rotation. And they no longer do rotating internships. Most of us, I don't know about your husband, we didn't come to medical school to be pathologists. Whoever heard of it? And you did a rotating internship and you began to see, you know, the physicians were spending their time with the wrong people and the pathologists were spending his time with the right people. You know, and some of us then decided to do pathology. But nowadays they don't do rotating internships, they do straight internships. They have to apply early in the senior year and they've never seen the practice of pathology. I've had dozens of medical students come back and say, in retrospect, the most fascinating year of my career was the second year of medical school when we did pathology. I learned more, it was more interesting, it was more exciting, but in their minds, it was like anatomy and physiology and biochemistry. It wasn't something that they saw as the practice of medicine. It was a basic science preparatory to the practice of medicine. And it's only when you make them realize that it's a fascinating way to practice medicine. If I can get my hands on a student for as little as 6 weeks, at least a third of them will change their mind about whatever it is they thought they wanted to be. I don't get my hands on any of them for 6 weeks.
So, in retrospect, looking upon your life as a pathologist, do you have any regrets at all?
Not at all.
Pathologists never do.
Never. I tell the medical students, if you really want to decide what to be, look at the people my age and find out how many of them still love what they're doing, are excited by what they're doing, feel that the horizons are completely open for what they want to do, and pathologists will win hands down. Many practicing physicians have begun to find it routine and dreary and dull, but that's how they make their living. And to relocate their offices would be, you know, within pathology, particularly nowadays when hospitals have 5, 6, 8, you know, 10 pathologists. If you get tired of running the microbiology lab, you say, you do microbiology, let me do hematology. let me do the chemistry for a while. You've been doing the OBGYN pathology. Let me do it. You do the pulmonary and you do the cardiovascular and you do whatever. You can switch within the job and never lose a beat and never lose a dollar's pay and never lose a day. And you can do more teaching or more research or more practice. And you have a tremendous level of flexibility that other people don't have.
You read a lot of philosophy.
No, a little bit, but most of it is, I mean, I've never people say you must have taken courses in management. I never took a management course in my life. But the obvious management things that you do, I always regarded as a subset of the scientific method. You know, as I said, I'm a trained problem solver. Whether it's dealing with people, whether it's dealing with computers, whether it's dealing with space, pathologists sort of do that. Good pathologists do that intuitively.
Right.
You're supposed to be in this room?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your room.
Thank you very much.
Very good, and thank you.
We've enjoyed it very
and
much.
I've enjoyed the opportunity. I hope I haven't said things I shouldn't have been on tape.